There are some seats in the front if council who are standing want to try to find them. Want to stand? All right. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Carter Phillips for General Electric. Judge Bates in this case correctly ruled that General Electric and all PRPs have a protectable property interest that arises out of the issuance of a unilateral administrative order by the Environmental Protection Agency. Where he erred, on the other hand, is when he applied the Matthews versus Eldridge factors to effectively balance away any kind of due process protections. And that's a position that this court categorically rejected in the Probert decision, where it said you cannot Matthews versus Eldridge away all due process under these particular circumstances.
Mr. Phillips, throughout your brief, you used the phrase that the UAO is an adjudicatory order. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you look at the UAOs, and the model one is at Joint Appendix 227, and the real one is between pages 780 and 848, just to give you some sense of the size and scope of these orders. And these orders contain a statement of jurisdiction, explicit findings of fact, which are ordinarily what you do in an adjudicative process, conclusions of law, very specific statements of work required, and the imposition of $2,500 per day fines as a consequence of failure to comply.
But they
with
don't
the very
they don't
precise.
Change legal rights and responsibilities, do they? It marks a stage in a process, right? And the process has not begun with the issuance of the UAO, has it?
No, but what
what's
it does,
the process begin with?
The process begins with the identification of the site.
And then what's next? What's the next step?
And then the EPA does an analysis and asks the parties to provide an investigation, and then there's a negotiation that typically follows during that course in a glass.
The UAO comes at the end of one part of the process, but it's the beginning of another part of the process, right?
To be sure, absolutely, Judge Griffith. But in that respect, it seems to me that the best case for the court to focus on is Jenkins versus McKeithen, where the court analyzed what exactly is it that the agency is doing specifically. And if it is, in fact, adjudicating and making very specific findings of fact and not simply leading to a legislative process, but in fact engaged in an adjudicative process, under those circumstances, due process applies, and we're entitled, generally speaking, to a pre-deprivation hearing.
So that's where we get to the meaning of the word adjudicative. I mean, when I think of the word adjudicative, I think of somebody who has power to set the rights, the competing rights and responsibilities. And as I read the UAO, it doesn't do that. It's a pretty significant step in a process, right? But it's not the end of the process.
Mr. Griffith, if you look at the very detailed specific requirements that they say you have to engage in this and this and this, very precise as to what it is you're required to do. And if you don't do those things, you are subject to a fine. And the fine is enormous, and it's of an indefinite period of time. It seems to me that combination, which candidly is a unique situation, but that combination of circumstances is what makes this subject to due process protections under those circumstances.
Let me ask you a couple of questions, if I might, just to help my understanding here. Now, if GE or some other entity does not comply with the UAO, if they choose not to comply, isn't it true that they're not going to pay a dime unless a court imposes the penalty on you, right?
Right, at the end of this process. On the other hand, during the entirety of this process, with the order having been issued, okay, what is the immediate consequence of that? There's an immediate stock drop. There's immediate access to the capital markets impairment, and there is a huge hit on the environmental brand of each of those PRPs.
And if I didn't agree with you that those implicated property interests, you're left with Dorr, right?
No, but I still think that McKeithen, Jenkins versus McKeithen, stands for the proposition that when an agency engages in an adjudicative process, that by itself
but it has to implicate a liberty interest or a property interest, right? You've got to find a property interest.
Right.
What I'm saying, if I don't agree with you that the three deprivations you've referred to trigger property interest, it comes down to Dorr for me, right? In this hypothetical setting, it's Dorr, right? Dorr's got to be the case that that you look to find a property interest?
Well, Doar is an easy case, I agree with you, because under those circumstances...
I didn't say it was an easy case. I said...
Well, it was easy enough for the Supreme Court, I suppose, but in any event...
It was a lien, right? It was a lien. You've got to... What is there about the UAO that works like a lien? Does it cloud title?
Yes, of course it does. It clouds everything with respect to what you're doing with that specific site.
Does it create a property interest in another entity? Lien creates a property interest in the lien holder. Does EPA have a property interest in the property?
Not in the precise way that the court recognized in Doar. But again, Judge Griffith, it seems to me that that's not the dividing line, that that's not the minimum requirement in order to trigger a due process protection. It seems to me this court has to look back at Jenkins.
What is then?
Jenkins says that when an agency of the government engages in a very specific adjudicative process, makes specific findings of fact, and that those findings of fact have consequential injuries that flow to them, which it seems to me describes precisely our situation, in that circumstance, you're entitled either to a pre-deprivation hearing in the absence of exigent circumstances or a prompt post-deprivation hearing.
Let's go back to the language of Doar. The language of Doar is similar encumbrances, right, to a lien or an attachment.
Right, to be sure.
Now you recognize this is not similar to a lien and attachment in the sense that I just identified, that it doesn't create a property interest in the lien holder, right?
There is not a specific document that's going to be filed in any court that's going to...
So let's just focus on Doar. So how is Doar helpful to your case then?
Because Doar says that if you can satisfy that initial triggering event, that one of the things that ought to help you in evaluating that are the consequential injuries that flow. I mean, the court spends a lot of time looking at consequential injuries that are very simple.
But that's leaping over the consequential injuries that flow from the deprivation of a property right. And it seems to me, I'm trying to get at Doar to help me understand what the property right here is. If I don't agree with your argument that stock value and access to capital markets and brand value implicates property interest.
Right, and Judge Griffith, that, it seems to me, Doar may not tell you, the may not be the complete answer on that, because Doar is obviously a sufficient, but I would submit not a necessary condition for the protection of due process to apply. And to figure out where the necessary protection is, you should step back and look at Jenkins. And because the Supreme Court in Jenkins specifically says that all that flows out of that is a very specific set of findings that are adverse to the party involved, and then the consequential injury that flows from those very specific findings, and the court said due process applies in that.
Jenkins is pre-Paul v. Davis, right?
Yes, Judge Dadle.
Isn't Paul v. I don't show you how you reconcile Paul with Jenkins with Paul. This case looks, to me at least, when it comes to these consequential consequences, effect on brand, stock prices, looks a lot like Paul versus Davis.
It seems to me that it looks a lot more like Jenkins than Paul, but
why?
At a minimum, because Paul versus Davis is nothing but a list of individuals who've engaged in wrongdoing that's posted in a particular area, and the complaint was that reputational injury all by itself is sufficient to trigger due process, and the court said no, under those circumstances,
so why,
there isn't
why
a right.
Why would it be different? So would Paul v. Davis be different if the decision to put him on the list was a result of an adjudication?
Yes, I think at that point, at least, the court would have to decide which case controls, Jenkins or Paul versus
Paul
Davis.
But Paul says that these consequential damages do not implicate a property right, or do not involve a property right that implicates due process.
Well, and I think in Paul, he actually focusing more as a liberty matter. But in any event, the reputational rights are not protected under those circumstances. But it does seem to me that if you go back to Jenkins, where it's talking about very specific findings of fact, very specific adjudicatory-like order leading to consequential harms, reinforced by Doar's focus on consequential harms. And what we're asking for here is to be sure, a step in the direction of protecting due process rights, but one that seems to me is completely justified given the circumstances that we have here where the injury is so palpable under these circumstances, as even Judge Bates himself recognized that the harms here, we're talking about individuals and companies that are bankrupted as a consequence of this particular scheme, and without any opportunity for a hearing prior to the issuance of the order, and no realistic opportunity afterwards.
Did, Did Goldman Sachs have a right to a hearing before the SEC filed its fraud suit against it?
No, of course not, because that's just a set of allegations.
No, well, they're alleging that they violated the law. That's no different than here.
Well, no, this is very different because this is because the order in this case makes specific findings of fact, not simply allegations, creates a
But they're both the same in the sense that in both the SEC's case against Goldman Sachs and in the EPA's UAO, it still has to prove them in court. You can force, GE can force them to prove that in court. And that they're identical in that sense.
Well,
and Goldman Sachs lost 10% of its value the day they filed the SEC complaint.
To be sure.
But, and there's lots of articles about how it destroyed its brand.
Right.
I don't see the difference.
Because we are saying that the dividing line is between an adjudicated order in form, even if it's not in fact, which is exactly what the court focused on in Jenkins,
and it's all
leading to
Jenkins.
Consequential injuries. And it's got to be in that form. If it's not in that form, I agree with you.
And suppose we thought that the analysis post-Matthew and post-Paul was different.
Well, then this court would have to be overruling Jenkins.
Well, no, maybe
sure
the Supreme Court did that in Paul.
Well,
and
first
Matthews.
Of all, the court didn't say anything about right. Jenkins and Paul.
Right.
So I would argue that there would be no basis for this court to reach that conclusion. But it seems to me mm-hmm. Jenkins is a controlling decision in this case, mm-hmm. and
you
that the court ought to
you
apply.
You didn't use it in your blue brief, though, did you?
We didn't focus on it because we thought we were sort of over that particular hurdle, mostly on the basis that of the combination of Doar and the fact that the district judge had made a finding that there was a protected interest. When the government then made its argument very specifically saying that the world will come to an end as we know it under these rulings, then we focused more on precisely what's the line that gets drawn in the way the court analyzes these issues. And as I say, when you have a separate right or a separate interest a la Doar and some of the other decisions, that one's easy. That's the sufficient. That's clearly sufficient. Question is, where short of that can you nevertheless be protected under the Due Process Clause from bankrupting liability under these circumstances? And what the Supreme Court said in Jenkins is, when it's an adjudicated determination under those circumstances and it has those kinds of consequential injuries that flow from it, in that circumstance, and it's a narrow circumstance. We're not asking for a broad rule. But and you ought to put it in context, Your Honors. This is what we have here. EPA's process is not followed by any other agency under any other circumstances at all. So asking the agency under these circumstances to provide some form of an opportunity for a meaningful hearing before a neutral and detached decision maker at some point in this process, rather than either no hearing prior to
the uniqueness of it seems to me doesn't prove much. It proves Congress was concerned, right? There's a great national issue. Congress was deeply concerned and brought out an awfully big club, right?
Well,
but that doesn't answer the due process inquiry. The due process inquiry, to me, has to start with the property interest, right?
And well, there's no question, Judge Griffith, but to put it into context, I mean, it would seem to me that it is quite improbable that Congress thinks that what EPA does in the context of Superfund is wildly different from what it does in every other context, or that what the SEC does or what a whole lot of other federal agencies do in order to protect the public interest are vastly different, that this is so unique in its approach. And so all I'm suggesting is
there's a public health element to this, and that's different than some of the other examples.
But Judge Griffith, OSHA, MSHA, I mean, mine safety, I mean, those are all areas that have exactly the same kinds of, and you could argue, even more significant public health concerns. And yet, in all of those contexts, there's an opportunity for a hearing either prior to or very soon after the order is issued in those contexts. And this is the only one.
You keep saying that, but I mean,
I'm hoping you'll eventually agree with me if I say it often.
At the outset, let's make it clear. The treasurer from GE will never have to write a check. If GE chooses not to comply, will never have to write a check until after they've had an opportunity to go into an Article III court and make their case, right?
Right, but in the interim, Judge Griffith, they have had an adjudication in form that they're a violator of the law. They have to make a public announcement that they are not going to comply with a duly issued order of an agency of the federal government. They are going to incur as a consequence of that $32,500 per day fines that are triggered.
They get back if they win, right?
at the end of a 5 to 7 year process, right. Judge Griffith. So it seems to me that obviously I haven't pushed the ex parte Young element of this.
The idea that there's no process afforded here at all is a stretch. The question is whether there's an adequate process. And the initial question is whether any process is necessary because a property interest has been implicated. Well, but the idea that no process has been afforded here is...
Well, I guess it depends on how you want to analyze process. But as I understand what due process requires at its core minimum is a meaningful opportunity to be heard at a meaningful time. And what I suggest to you is that a meaningful opportunity to deal with a non-exigent circumstance order that is the product of 5 years where the agency simply uses it as a sledgehammer...
And we'll ask your co-counsel about their view of how that statute works, which seems a little odd to me. But
I want to ask. Were you done?
Yes.
Yeah. Would you explain? Let's assume that we thought the district court had jurisdiction over your pattern and practice claim.
Yes.
Right. You have two separate claims, right?
Yes, Justice.
Your facial challenge and the pattern and practice claim. How does the constitutional analysis under that differ from under your facial claim?
Well, on the facial claim, our basic argument is that we are never entitled to a hearing under these circumstances because you don't get a pre-deprivation hearing and the impact of this scheme is so coercive that you cannot, in fact, have a post-deprivation hearing because nobody will go through that process. And indeed, there are only 3 instances out of 5,000 wherever anybody has ever tried that, which suggests that it is an extraordinarily coercive and not effective means.
Well, it might also suggest that because of the procedures that EPA goes through before it issues one, that people have decided not to challenge it.
Well, Judge Tatel, if you focus on just to use the one example of the Fleischer Paint situation, where the argument all along was that we were not a PRP within the meaning of the statute. Uh-huh. You may eventually just run out of steam. You know, the question is, are you just going to comply and then take your chances down the road at some point? But by complying, you clearly have lost a property interest under those circumstances.
Let me ask you the question. Let me see if I can ask the question this way. Suppose, notwithstanding your argument about Jenkins and Doar, just suppose we thought that with respect to your constitutional claim, to the extent there are property rights, they're fully protected under the Due Process Clause by the ability to go to court eventually, and that we don't think the loss of stock value and brand impact is a property right subject to due process. Let's just assume that for a minute. Is there a different constitutional analysis for your pattern and practice claim?
No, I think the question on the pattern and practice turns more on what processes do under what circumstances, because while the facial challenge would be subject at least to some argument with respect to Salerno, the pattern and practice claim clearly would not. And in evaluating that, what we know absolutely to a moral certainty, because the government concedes it, is that this is not used in emergency circumstances that would justify the denial of a pre-deprivation hearing. And therefore, it seems to me we have a stronger argument that we are entitled to some opportunity to be heard in a meaningful way before a neutral and detached decision maker prior to the deprivation.
No, but my hypothetical was based on you losing your argument that there is a property right here that requires a pre-deprivation hearing.
I'm sorry, Judge Tatel.
My hypothetical was based on the assumption that we disagree with you that there is either a protectable property right or one that requires a hearing. If you lose that,
we lose.
You lose on your.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Obviously, you have to have the irreducible minimum of a property interest of some sort that triggers the protections of due process.
But there's nothing about the pattern practice claim that changes that analysis,
right? It doesn't change that analysis. It changes the back end analysis, I would submit to you.
That I understand.
Of what process ought to be applied.
Right.
All right. Let us hear from the government.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Sambhav Sankar for the United States EPA.
I want to start out very simply by pointing out a very large hole in GE's adjudication argument. Their reply brief, which cited Jenkins versus McKeithen for the first time, wasn't even in the opening brief, seems to argue that EPA...
That's supposed to be a compliment to you, though.
I guess. and I'll take it. But it's GE's bringing a facial claim here. They have to show that the statute, in every situation, deprives them of due process. And if you look at Section 106 of CERCLA, there's nothing in there about findings. There's nothing in there about statements about jurisdiction. There's nothing in there about 90-page reports. EPA does those things because EPA is talking to PRPs before they issue the UAOs. EPA does this as part of its process of ensuring that that PRPs get processed before the UAO
shows. But the process, by EPA's own admission, they're not evidentiary hearings, right?
Your Honor, I think you may have misled, at least in some degree, by some of GE's statements. GE quotes a lot of documents from EPA saying these things are not hearings, they're not intended to provide due process. Right. Those are statements in the unilateral administrative orders themselves. So our argument...
What takes place beforehand?
What takes place beforehand is several things. First of all, EPA does what's called a PRP search. When they go and they find a site, somebody calls them up and says there's leaking barrels or something at this site. Mm-hmm. They look around. They try to find out who owns the site, who has owned the site, who may have brought the barrels there. They contact all these people. And these things, by the way, are in policy documents that I've included in the joint appendix. They send out... They then have initial conversations with PRPs for several reasons. First, to say, are you potentially liable? Do you know about this? And crucially, do you know of other people who might be liable here? Let's collect the information and see who might be liable for this. And during that process, it is routine for the PRPs to bring lawyers with them, lots of lawyers, and they will talk a lot about how they might be liable.
Big building lawyers, right?
Right.
Tall
exactly.
Building lawyers, is they?
Lots of lawyers. And EPA then sends out formal notice letters and says, we have officially determined that we think you're a PRP. Come on back if we're wrong. Talk to us. Then there's further process that can sometimes issue special notice letters from EPA that prohibits EPA from taking enforcement actions. And then I think it's interesting, despite the statements in UAOs that EPA says, look, you know, this order is now final, at least with respect to the agency. You want to complain about this, go to a court. EPA even then still changes orders routinely. And I found this interesting. If you look at the district court's own opinion, GE tried to show that EPA had made errors by identifying sites at which EPA had changed its UAOs after they had issued. On page 36 of the district court's opinion, he talks about this. He says, well, you know, there might have been an error at this site because after the PRP explained that this remedy was all wrong.
You're saying that's a result of the good process?
It's a result of process. First of all, we think there's very good process before the UAO issues. Second of all, we think GE is flatly wrong to say that after the UAO issues, EPA locks the doors and refuses to talk to any PRP. That's simply wrong. But more generally, I want to make the point that GE's claims about adjudications have to be made in the context of a facial challenge to the statute. And as long as they're saying that it's EPA's findings that are causing the problem, they're not making a facial claim. They need to raise an as-applied claim.
Since they only raised the Jenkins case in the reply brief, what's your answer to it?
Well, two things. I think Judge Tatel has hit one of the nails on the head, which is that it's hard to reconcile with Paul versus Davis. And in all candor, Your Honor, I think if you look at the factual circumstances of what happened in Jenkins versus McKeithen, they're pretty illuminating. The court had decided Hanna versus Larch a few years earlier, and it said that the Civil Rights Commission could conduct its investigations, and without casting any aspersions on the great state of Louisiana, it looks like Louisiana developed a commission to harass labor organizers using a similar technique. If you look at the opinion, it's clear that they viewed this as essentially a commission designed to cast opprobrium on the people who were defendants, and that the sole purpose of this commission was to destroy the lives of the people that they were going after. And I think that that's a circumstance that's very important when you look at those cases. I also think it's very important that if you look at recent due process history, as Your Honor cited, Doar and all these things, Jenkins versus McKeithen is not the generative case in those things. It's Paul versus Davis. Paul versus Davis is what the law is on due process, Your Honor.
No, of course, Paul didn't say anything about Jenkins.
They're both
Supreme Court decisions that we're bound by.
That is true. And Jenkins, I think the key distinction then in Jenkins, couple of key
things. The courts told us again and again, they overrule their decisions, not us. Right?
Fair enough, Your Honor.
I guess someone actually tried to do that, otherwise they wouldn't have said it. But We got the message. So what do? Jenkins is right out there. It's clear.
You're right. And Jenkins involved a statement of criminal liability about individual people. It said we are branding this person essentially a criminal. The only person who could refer these people to the commission was the governor. The governor handpicked all the commission members. I think there were, to be perfectly honest, Your Honor, I think there were a lot of things going on that factored into the court's decision that this was a organization created to harass and intimidate, and that finding of criminal liability was the sole purpose. There wasn't anything else that happened as a result of that. Here, EPA has a program of cleaning up sites. This is one piece of a much larger program, as Your Honor recognized.
Well, let's talk about that larger program. How come EPA doesn't use abatement actions? Congress gave you three ways to go about it. It doesn't seem like EPA uses one.
And if,
why not?
If by abatement actions you mean how come we don't go sue PRPs to compel them?
Right.
Well, the analogy
Their day in court up front. Why didn't EPA do that?
Your Honor, because the focus is on trying to get the sites cleaned up first.
Well, but does it say, I mean, Congress, you talked about an overall scheme here. Mm-hmm. Congress created an overall scheme. EPA seems not to be disregarding one of the tools Congress gave them. Why?
Because it's found that, I think when Congress designed some of these tools, they didn't anticipate the length of the litigation that can sometimes ensue in these things. And when you have a site that presents...
You talked about Congress's anticipation. Do you think that Congress anticipated using the UAOs this way and this number of times with this frequency?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I mean, to be perfectly honest, I do think that in giving EPA three options, I think it's hard to strike one option off the table because they're not using another option, because EPA isn't using another option enough. I do think it's important to recognize.
Don't you? I think it is instructive to figure out what Congress is trying to do here, and the fact that the UAO seems to be the type of remedy that one would use in an emergency situation, and it's not even used in an emergency situation right now. It's the standard operating procedure, right?
Your Honor, we may never come to a complete agreement on how UAOs are used in every case, but I'm not trying to defend every single UAO that EPA has had to issue. GE is attacking every single UAO that EPA has ever issued. It's their facial claim. In order to win, all we have to do is show that there's one legitimate way to use a UAO out there. GE itself has conceded that those situations exist. We are not trying to close the door on every challenge to a UAO. In fact,
what about the pattern and practice?
Yeah, right.
The pattern and practice claim, Your Honor. First of all, GE seems to think that this court held in GE 2.
Well, suppose they're wrong about that.
Held that a pattern and practice claim.
No, suppose we didn't. Suppose we said nothing about it. But they still argue that the district court has jurisdiction to hear their pattern and practice claim.
Your Honor,
that's their argument.
I understand, and I think the problem for them is that Section 113H of CERCLA says you can't challenge any order in court. And in order,
they're not challenging an order. They say very specifically,
right,
they're challenging no order.
If they're not challenging an order,
they're just using orders as evidence of their argument that there's a pattern and practice here that creates constitutional problems. That's their argument.
If they're not challenging any order, they're not challenging any injury that they've suffered, and they're not seeking redress for anything. And here's the way you can see that. What's the relief, Your Honor, that they would be seeking? It's never been clear to me what relief they're seeking as a result of this pattern and practice claim. Do they want
take their argument about one of their arguments is that hearings? The 10-day conferences, the ones that occur 10 days after the issuance of the UAO,
mm-hmm.
right? Their argument is that, look, it used to be that at least at those we could argue liability. Now we can't, all right? We can only, agency has limited those to questions of compliance.
And, Your Honor, the way courts work is that when GE has one of those 10-day conferences and it feels like it's been deprived of due process at that, it can show up in court and say, we want to complain about this. It can refuse to comply with the UAO, and it can get a day in court to challenge a case-by-case consideration.
What prohibits it from raising it here? This is your McNary argument, right?
It's their McNary argument, Your Honor. It's our position based on Section 113H and Article 3 principles. Section 113H says you can't challenge any order.
But they're not challenging an order. They're challenging a practice.
No, they're challenging a practice. And when you say you're challenging a practice, you've walked into Lujan versus National Wildlife Federation. You've walked into Lujan versus Defenders of Wildlife. Those cases say that courts don't exist to be roving commissions to examine how agencies are doing their job. Courts evaluate individual instances
and,
of
and
agency
they allege conduct. That they are the subject of many UAOs. You don't disagree with that?
We don't disagree.
And they argue there's a pattern in practice of denying them an opportunity at these 10-day conferences to discuss liability. That's a fact that can be resolved and adjudicated without reviewing any individual UAM.
That's impossible, Your Honor.
Why?
I mean, with all due respect, how do you know whether or not EPA... First of all, we'd have to be sure that it was GE that was denied one of these things, because it could be that EPA has given GE plenty of process and it just does it to everybody else except for GE. There's no way to know that without looking at GE's individual orders, without looking at the way the order was issued, without looking at the factual history. In fact, if you look at GE's arguments in district court, they repeatedly talk about their own orders and contest them and say, oh, well, this UAO was wrong because we weren't liable at that site. This UAO was wrong because the remedy was too broad. All of these things show you that, at essence, you cannot adjudicate one of these pattern and practice claims without doing one of two things, either challenging the agency's administration of the statute purely in the abstract, or challenging an individual UAO that you've got. There's two kinds of claims that come in court. There's facial claims, and there's as-applied claims. GE is trying to go in the middle and do something totally new. Your Honor, I do want to mention a couple of facts that GE has mentioned. It is concerned, apparently, that EPA is bankrupting companies with UAOs. GE can say that at the lectern, but there's nothing in the evidence suggesting that EPA has ever bankrupted a company with a unilateral administrative order. Not only that, EPA has guidance and policies showing that their ability to pay criteria for UAOs, and crucially, as Judge Griffith himself recognized, EPA doesn't set these penalties. A district court sets these penalties, and that distinction is crucial. I also want to step back briefly. I realize this court didn't discuss much with GE the concern about stock prices and brand values and all those things. We do think that Connecticut versus Dorr is a case about property. It's a case where Supreme Court said there's a stick in your hand, and it's been plucked away from you before you've had a chance to say your piece in front of a district court judge. Until you get that chance, you can't take that stick away. Again, our position is a UAO takes no sticks. And again, as for the adjudication, that's not a facial challenge. If they want to challenge an individual UAO and the findings in it, they can bring that. There's no further questions.
Thank you. Counsel for appellant.
Thank you, Your Honor.
What's your answer to this last point that government counsel responded to my argument about, that there's two approaches here? You either file a facial challenge, which you've done, and you've conceded that it can be applied constitutionally in some circumstances, or you challenge a particular order. This third way is not acceptable.
It seems to me that the Supreme Court specifically recognized that there's a third way in McNary, where it identified a pattern in practice. And if you think about it logically, it only makes sense.
Right.
Let's assume that the allegation here were that EPA only issues UAOs against African Americans. Now, on its face, obviously, you've got no basis for challenging it. Under the statutory scheme, you can't challenge it as it arises in a specific order. But if you could, in fact, get the same kind of concession out of EPA that we got in this case with respect to the UAOs never used in an emergency.
How would GE have standing in a case like that?
Let's assume that they only issue them against white corporations that are, all I'm saying is that there would be somebody under those circumstances clearly who would have standing, and I have no doubt that the court would entertain a pattern in practice claimed in that context, just as the Supreme Court recognized in McNary.
Even where there were opportunities to get judicial relief?
Yeah, well, obviously my argument is that we don't really have a realistic opportunity to get judicial relief, but I think the reason why the world normally breaks down into facial versus as-applied challenges is because you don't have the 113H problem in most contexts.
Right.
And it's only in this context where, frankly, Congress said, look, we don't want you to be evaluating each individual order, but didn't say that you can't challenge other aspects of what's unconstitutional, either as a pattern of practice or facially.
Okay, but let me go back to this, to the standing implications of this, and my question to government counsel about the 10-day conferences. I mean, seems to me, just from looking at it, it looks to me like that if that's a pattern in practice of saying you can't discuss liability at those things, it's something that should be subject to challenge. I don't myself see why that would be barred by 113H. But what about the standing problem?
Well, I don't see any standing issue here. I mean, the government keeps going to Lujan. Lujan is a case that deals with a challenge to a regulation involving activities in foreign countries. We're talking about a situation of a company that has been subject to UAOs, that is currently subject to UAOs, right. Would in a moment's notice, if told that they're entitled to due process protections, seek to exercise those rights in precisely the way you specified, Judge Tatel, that we're entitled to have some kind of a determination by a neutral and detached decision maker at some point in this process. So it seems to me that if that's not a case of where you have standing, it's very difficult for me to understand under what circumstances you would. You know, Judge Griffith, you're absolutely right. I mean, this was a scheme that was designed to deal with two situations. In an ordinary situation, you go to court. In an emergency, you issue the unilateral administrative order. No one imagined a scheme in which you would have the federal...
Why hasn't Congress fixed it?
Well, Congress doesn't fix a lot of problems, but the reality is that when this scheme operates the way it is under these circumstances, at some point it candidly violates the Due Process Clause, and then it becomes an issue, obviously, for the Article III entities as opposed to the others at this particular stage. And what we're talking about here is an enormously coercive scheme. We don't have an opportunity at the end. Counsel for the other side said, well, if you didn't like that 10-day dealing, you can go to court. That's not true. If we don't comply, we wait until after the government completes what it's going to do while the size of the fines increase every day. The only adjudicated case under these circumstances, that PRP got hit with 5 years of fines. Because it approached it that way.
And they wouldn't have to pay any of them if in defending the action that the agency brings, they show they're either not liable or they had sufficient basis for their position.
But no, Judge Tatel, it's not an accident. There have been 5,000 of these things, and only one of them has been close to a final adjudication under these circumstances. That is simply not a realistic alternative under these circumstances. If there are no further questions, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Urge you to vacate and remand.
Under advisement.